Hello, you. Welcome to You Are Good, a Feelings podcast about movies. Today, we're talking about Cruising. We're talking about it with Marcus McCann. I am one of your hosts, Alex Steed, and I will soon be joined by my marvelous co-host, Sarah Marshall. Cruising is a 1980 crime thriller film written and directed by William Friedkin. It is loosely based on the novel of the same name by New York Times reporter Gerald Walker about a serial killer targeting gay men in the 1970s. The title is a double entendre, this is more from Wikipedia, because cruising can describe both police officers on patrol and men who are cruising for sex. And then more from Wikipedia, just to provide a little bit of context for this conversation. Poorly received by critics upon release, Cruising performed moderately at the box office. The shooting and promotion were dogged by gay rights protesters who believed that the film stigmatized them. I'm letting you know that right now because that is a lot of what we'll be talking about in this very conversation with Marcus McCann. Marcus, you can hear over on You're Wrong About talking about George Michael and George Michael parts one and two, and the relationship between George Michael and Cruising is why we're talking about the movie Cruising with Marcus over here. So this is a companion piece to that series. Marcus McCann is a lawyer who has been involved in a number of high-profile legal projects in the areas of sexuality and LGBTQ rights. Marcus is the author of Park Cruising, What Happens When We Wander Off the Path. Very excited to talk about this episode with you. It is about a serial killer. It is about a serial killer that targets folks in the gay community. It's about death and violence that's perpetrated against queer people. So please keep all of that in mind. We don't go into great detail about any of those pieces, but that is something that is going to come up in the episode. I should let you know what You Are Good is about if this is your first episode. You Are Good is a show where we watch movies and we use our conversations about those movies to understand what it's like to be a person in the world, what it's like to have feelings, what it's like to experience the complicated nature of being alive, and just issues are being addressed in one way or another by what is represented on screen. So know that. That is how we address things. We're not film critics. We are people who watch movies as a means of having some text to help us understand what it's like to be just in the world. How are you doing? How's it going on in your world? What is happening with you? Let us know what you're watching. Let us know what you're thinking about over at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod on social media. Depending on which one, it's You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Find us over there. And don't forget that you, my friend, you are good. Thank you so much for being here. You Are Good, a Feelings podcast about movies, is made possible with and by your support. Thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions. We appreciate you. And those who support us over on Patreon and Apple Podcast subscriptions get bonus episodes. About once a month, you get a director's cut episode. And then you also get episodes about stuff that we're not covering on the main feed. This month, we're talking about The Iron Claw, which I am stoked about. We're talking about it with Mike Eagle. Open Mike Eagle. Check it out. If you are a supporter, as I am, of Ceasefire, please look into actions that are taking place in your area that are calling for ceasefire. And things are heating up on campuses, particularly with regard to speech and these sorts of efforts. So find ways to get involved. And if you are looking for a way to be supportive materially, please get in touch with the folks at Palestine Children's Relief Fund. We will have a link to them and their efforts in the show notes. All right, that's it for this introduction to this episode of You Are Good at Feelings podcast about movies. Thank you so much for being here. We appreciate you. Let's get cruising. Hello, Sarah Marshall.
Hips or lips, Alex Steed.
I'm glad that's the direction you went. Sarah, what are we in store for today? And why?
Oh, and why? Okay, I thought there was more. Today, we're talking about Cruising, one of the most memorably incoherent films of the late 20th century. And we were talking about it with Marcus McCann, my George Michael expert in residence over at You're Wrong About.
Hell yeah. Marcus, hello. How are you?
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me.
I didn't see you come in here.
You let me in the back way.
What is the, Marcus, who are you in context of George Michael? And what are the overlapping themes of what y'all talked about on You're Wrong About and what will be happening in this movie?
Okay, my relationship to George Michael, no relation. I'm someone who's thought a lot about Park Cruising especially and recently published a book on the topic. So the backdrop of cruising culture in this film and also in George Michael's life, it's something that it has in common.
Excellent. And what did you have a relationship with Cruising, the movie, before diving into the George Michael research?
Yes. Cruising, the movie, is, I approached it as an adult for the first time. I knew it was a controversial film among queer people. And so when I first watched it, I was looking for both what is it that people love and why is it that people are so critical of it? Like, on the one hand, I think for a lot of queer fans, if you look at it just as this kind of noirish film, kind of like hard-boiled detective story, then you can say, well, the worldview of the film is a bit grim, but that's just part of the charm of it. And also for me, like, when I learned that many of the extras in the film were asked to bring their own clothes to set, it meant that the actors are either guys who are involved in the leather community or are at least adjacent to it. You know, like, maybe they're borrowing their roommate's clothes or something. But because of that, I think that there's a feeling that some of those scenes contain a kernel of authenticity, which people really responded to. And I think looking back on the film, that's part of what I respond to in it.
Sarah, what's your relationship with Cruising?
As we've talked about many times on the show, when I was 13, IFC was showing The Celluloid Closet very frequently. And that was a very important movie for me. And so Cruising is like an entire act in that documentary as like part of a group of films, but as sort of a moment unto itself historically of overt and extreme homophobia in media. And there's a chant that I always hear in my head when I think about it, where protesters are chanting, "Stop the movie Cruising," because you can't just say "stop cruising." It would be insane. And so then seeing it, I think probably in around college age, it's become kind of a camp favorite for me because it doesn't make sense. Like, the messaging is somewhat clear and you can use it, I think, to like take the temperature of the culture in 1980 in a way that to me sort of anthropologically is very useful. But also it's just like a bad movie in a kind of delightful way.
We talked recently in the Virgin Suicides episodes about movies that took on a different life through their gifification on Tumblr. And this is
gifting all over the place.
The gift everywhere. This is one of them. Like, this is a movie whose gifs I know
really
more strongly than the movie. Yeah, totally.
What are the Cruising gifs?
Al Pacino dancing.
Oh, well,
big time.
Yeah.
Guy walking into room and hitting Al Pacino and him saying, "What was that?"
Well, that's the best part.
Yeah, totally. Like, lots of the leather. I think it's because, to Marcus's point, like, right or wrong with regard to like what the movie was capturing, it's one of the earliest, highest quality captures of these environments on screen. So like, it's not documentary, but it is.
But it is very a documentary,
right,
to paraphrase Caroline O'Donohue, just like The Exorcist, William Friedkin's lesser known film.
Exactly. And so I think that that's what made a lot of that imagery endure outside of the context of the movie. I'm excited. I mean, this is a fucking weird movie. I also like that, like, this is a movie, again, like, that I knew bits of, but hadn't watched from start to finish. And I should have known because it's noir, right?
We've watched this movie together.
Yeah. And you know how my brain works. It's bad. It's bad inside. It's bad in here. But I didn't recall
because I think the controversy lives in a bigger way than the movie itself, I just didn't recall that, like, the primary message is cops are bad. Like, the
oh, I don't think that's the message at all.
Oh, I take the message is like, they're bad. Like, the politics are going to, like, get in the way. They're not going to do the right thing. Like, mm-hmm. I can't wait to talk about that. Sarah, mm-hmm. take us underground.
Oh, my God. All right. So Cruising opens without a protagonist. Love it for the first 15 minutes.
Or you're squinting going, is this Al Pacino?
And it never is. It's just a bunch of other guys. And so we start in a leather bar in media res, and a killer wearing mirrored sunglasses takes a guy with a great pickup line. He's like, I have ego issues. I need to be worshipped and adored.
Ooh, so hot. So hot.
You're just like, all right, this is going to be healthy. Healthy attachments. And I'm not saying that sarcastically. Self-esteem is so rare. And so they go to a hotel. And what should his date do but stab him while singing a little song, which you simply must do as a killer in a movie. Mm-hmm. He has a little song he sings that goes, who's here? I'm here. We're here.
It's the sort of thing you sing when you're alone at your house for too long and you just...
It's the kind of thing you sing to your cats. And so then the body is found in the river by some guy on a tugboat or something, I guess. And there's an exorcist connection to all this famously, which is that what people, if you ask them about it, will generally say is the scene from The Exorcist that bothered them most, the scene where they're doing the medical testing on Regan. One of the med techs actually turned out to, I think, be a serial killer within the gay community. Is that, Marcus, is that correct?
I think he's at least accused of killing one gay man. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So of course we get movie grade inflation. We're like, killing one person is boring. You got to kill at least six people to get Americans to pay attention.
This needs to be a myth.
But yeah, there was always, I think, attached to this movie, this element of the story finding William Friedkin, who then, of course, had no idea what to do with it. So we open with a murder. We then see the police responding to it. Paul Sorvino is on the case. He's linking this to previous murders in the community. He needs to get serious. He needs to find this serial killer. And so he decides to put a dazzling task force of one guy with no experience on it. And that guy is Al Pacino. And we introduce him with my favorite part of the movie, which is Paul Sorvino saying he's sending him out undercover to try and find this leather bar serial killer because you fit the profile. All the victims have dark hair, dark eyes, and are in their late 20s.
How does Paul Sorvino, like, what are his first phrases to Al Pacino in order to entice him into this job? Do you recall?
He's like, yeah, you ever want to disappear?
What's he saying? He's like, do you ever suck hog?
We've got balloons down here.
He starts by, like, sexually harassing him.
Well, yeah, of course. It's how men work.
I was like, where is this going?
Yeah. So Paul Sorvino is like, because we're taking these crimes so seriously, we're having one guy in his late 20s, just say 30s. Doesn't matter. One guy in his late 20s go undercover. He's going to infiltrate the leather bars. We're not going to have anyone talk to him about the culture. No one's going to help him with any of this. We're just going to chuck him in there and he has to figure it out. And so he goes for it. His girlfriend is played by Karen Allen, who lives in a beautiful loft full of healthy houseplants. And she only has one record and she plays it all the time.
I gasped when I saw her apartment.
That's the real story.
There are so many doors out of that apartment, and I don't know where any of them go.
Right? Where does the back part go to? And so Al Pacino goes undercover. He goes to a bunch of different bars, and these are, from my understanding, real bars in New York at the time. We also are introduced to a couple of cops who, unless I really miss something, never get any kind of comeuppance.
No.
Who are, you know, just sexually assaulting trans women.
Yeah. Their only comeuppance is, like, at the very end of the movie, one of them is recognized by Paul Sorvino.
But, you know.
Who chooses to do nothing.
Right. That to me was like, all right, cops don't look great.
Yeah, it is like interestingly the uncommented on backdrop of this movie that the cops are kind of horrible.
Yeah, our introduction to them is like them just being monsters mm-hmm. to the community they're engaging.
I think in the very first scene in the coroner's office too, the police officer's like, don't tag this as a homicide because I don't have time to investigate it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then they mark it as cuppy.
What's the guy say? He's like, the only time that you guys will sort of move on a case is when someone is signing their admission.
Yeah. And then, so Al Pacino moves into his undercover apartment in the village and he immediately meets world's friendliest neighbor, Don Scardino, the star of Squirm.
I don't know what that is.
We've got some star power. The MST3K movie with the worms.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Beardsley.
Amazing. His pal, Mr. Exposition.
Mr. World's Friendliest Exposition Neighbor, who takes him out for a cup of coffee and a burger and tells him about how to be gay. And we find out very late in this movie that his dancer roommate, who's away in, I think, Connecticut, touring a show, is played by none other than James Remar, Richard yeah. Wright from Sex and the City.
I love James Remar in everything.
He's fantastic.
And I was delighted to see him.
Very at the very end, save the best for last.
He has quite a haircut in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and so Al Pacino starts going to the leather bars, and we also have learned through Don Squirm Scardino that we have like the inevitable like moment in one of these movies that you can easily miss if you're eating a particularly loud piece of popcorn. And also Paul Sorvino mentions this too, that like leather bars are a subculture. So they say it twice and then the movie is like, all right, that was probably enough times. We don't have to keep worrying about what's a subculture. And to me, it really feels like from that point, they're just like, we've said our little asides and now it's just being gay equals going to a leather bar every night. And that's just the only way to do it.
Yeah.
I do appreciate in that conversation, Al Pacino's character says something like, oh, I'm sure the police will get him.
Right.
And Ted says in response, if they get him, they'll make him a member of the Vice Squad. Like they'll promote him.
I love that line.
It's like Kylo Ren working undercover Starkiller base.
I love that.
It's like, well, our New York City's finest will certainly take him down shortly. Yeah. And so then he starts going to the clubs that night. And I do feel for him as an introvert because they're so loud.
There's so much looking.
There's so much looking. He has to stand against a wall while men decide whether they like him or not. It's too stressful.
The camera also does a lot of looking. And I love the kind of like pan across a row of butts the first time we're in the leather bar.
Yeah. And I do, to what you were saying, I think these are the parts of the movie that are most enjoyable when you're just like looking at a bar and the people in it.
And everyone seems to be having a good time.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. And I only know any of this because I did a couple of shows with our friend Woody Shticks about Robert Letourneau in the context of the Boys in the Band. And I know that, you know, like the Boys in the Band is interesting because of its on-screen portrayal of a bunch of gay men. One of William Friedkin's biggest regrets is he never showed an on-screen kiss in that movie, or he sort of like held back on an on-screen kiss. And it feels like in the most weirdly executed way possible, he's trying to make up for not showing the on-screen kiss. Hmm. He's like, here's a bunch of butts. Here's some fisting on the dance floor. Like, here's all sorts of things that I'm trying to make up for by, like, not doing the thing that I should have done 10 years ago.
And it's like, but that movie was about a birthday party.
right, exactly. And to your point, Sarah, like, because there's, like, one weird muffled aside that tries to differentiate between what we're seeing going on, it really kind of ends up being messy.
I mean, yeah, speaking of fisting on the dance floor,
I feel like in these scenes, though, also there's an element of, let me see. Friedkin says that he went to these bars and he like was sort of a fly on the wall and watched them as preparation when he was writing the script and then before he directed it.
That must have been weird.
Totally.
Just sitting there with his notepad and a glass of Chianti.
But like completely absent from his self-description of this is, did he talk to anyone who was involved in the leather scene?
Yeah.
He just went and watched. And like, I feel like these scenes, we're seeing a depiction at a surface level of what you might see, but not like the sort of full human complexity of who these people are, like what they were doing beforehand or what they might do after.
Right.
I think that knowing that, it makes me read the scene where the guy asks essentially if he wants to get pissed on, and he's like, no, I just like to watch. And the guy's like, well, take that handkerchief out of your pocket. And it feels like a thing that must have happened to Friedkin, going to like go observe and like be in costume and then getting called out for like not participating, just being there to observe.
It's also like the casting is tough because Al Pacino, who I must stress, walks in after 15 minutes of movie. We've never seen him before. No backstory. Don't know what kind of life he's had. I don't think that every character in a movie has to have like an arc to be a compelling protagonist, but it helps to be vaguely attached to somebody. And he like starts this movie with the same 1,000-yard stare that he ends it with. So you're like, well, I guess he started off disturbed and then now he still is.
In one of his interactions with Nancy, he does say something like, it's been affecting me. Like, there's your emotional arc. That's the development.
Yeah. He's been affected, everybody.
It's really interesting because, like, he goes there, to be loved and to have moments of sort of feeling connected. They share nothing about each other's life, really, that we see on screen. And then there's this scene later where he's going to leave being undercover. And he's talking to Paul Sorvino and has at least the text of which the most touching conversation about partnership that happens in the whole movie. And it's not with Nancy. Paul Sorvino looks at him and says, I need you. You're my partner and you can't let me down. We're up to our ass in this. I'm counting on you. And I was like, okay.
And you're also like, he's not your partner. He's your subordinate. Come on.
It's like, it's a real, like, we're all family at this workplace culture.
Yeah. Right. And he's like, very reasonably is like, I don't think I can do this job anymore. I am but one 40-year-old guy in his late 20s with pre-existing emotional issues. And our plan seems to be that I keep having park assignations with random men until one of them starts killing me. And like, not to jump ahead too far, but that actually works.
He's just bait.
In the book version, the police send out
a book?
Oh, this is based on a book from like earlier mid-70s by Gerald Walker.
Okay, that would answer some questions. All right. Wow.
Which is terrible and is hard to get now, I think for good reason. Yeah. But in the book version, the police send out 10 decoys.
Okay.
And the Al Pacino character is just the one that you're following throughout it.
Huh.
And like, that's also a weird fantasy of like allocation of police resources to protect the queer community.
Yeah.
Like, uh-huh. Sure. Sure. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we have, you know, another murder. We like keep being shown people we've never seen before. And it's like, all right. And so we watch this guy looking like he's headed for a nice weekend, and then he stops at an adult bookshop and peep show immediately finds a parking spot right in front. That's kind of the most amazing part of this movie. And then goes in for some companionable peep show sex and is again murdered by our killer. The most work that Al Pacino does detecting is that he learns that this guy, Lee, what is his name? Lee?
Skip? Skip Lee?
Skip? The guy who works at the steakhouse, something cute, Biffy, that people are like, yeah, he's aggressive. He goes for the throat. He's like, maybe he's the killer. And so he takes him to a hotel room, and then fucking like 12 cops run in to take them both down. So it looks like Al Pacino isn't in on it. And then they interrogate them. And then we get my other favorite scene in the movie. Which, Alex, would you like, what happens when we, what special interrogation tool do the police have?
They inexplicably have on the other side of a door in the interrogation room, a like Tom of Finland physiqued black man wearing kind of not like a jock strap, kind of like kind of a jock strap,
I mean, as far as I know,
and a cowboy hat
and nothing else
and nothing else. And he walks into the room and slaps Al Pacino in a way that I don't know anything about the production of this, it feels like they did that and did not give Al Pacino a heads up, because his genuine response of what was that? What was that?
It's called the old Ellen Burstyn.
It's so fantastic.
It's an open hand slap too, right? Like what?
Yes. Ooh. And then we later see this character, you know, sort of like behind the scenes in one of the police offices that Al Pacino goes in when he's talking to Paul Sorvino and takes the hat off of his head and I think throws it out the window.
So rude.
Right. Because once they're alone, he can sort of take the mask off and be like, we're both police officers. Like, what were you doing that for? Right.
Right.
And he's like, you twerp, and takes his hat and throws it out the window. No reaction, no consequences.
No, none. It's Henry Judd Baker, who you have seen him in one of many movies, probably having as much screen time as he did in this movie. Mm.
One of the former New York City police officers who was a consultant on this film, a guy named Randy Jerkinson, claims that this scene is based on something that really happened, that this was actually an interrogation technique that the New York City police had used before.
I just because of my views of the police generally, and also that I think like everywhere something psychosexual is being worked out, like I absolutely believe that this happened one time at a police precinct.
Oh, yeah. Why not?
But the result of that interrogation is, I think they conclude they got the wrong guy.
Yeah, they've been too hasty. And so and the restaurant he works at, the knives that they use there, I guess, for customers, like apparently the same or a similar knife was used in the stabbings. But that's not. Yeah, there's more to it. And then basically we just start seeing another character who we've seen from the nose down committing murders earlier, and we're like, oh, well, I guess that's him.
Well, this is where I just want to say about that interrogation. Mm-hmm. So they move in too early because, you know, I don't understand hierarchies always sort of within these structures of the movies, but like whoever Paul Sorvino's boss is getting heat from the organized gay community.
Because the cops are operating at the whim of the gays.
Right, right, right. Speaking to the fantasy of the endless resources of like 10 people out sort of in the field. The whole time I was like, it's really interesting that the police seem interested in this case in the way that they're interested. And then we learn about the heat that's coming from the organized gays. And then so they're like, I need an answer now. I don't care what the answer is. I just need you to get an answer. Paul Sorvino moves too early. Then we start to hear, and there's the parallel where Al Pacino is losing himself a little bit in his role and losing himself in his relationship to Nancy Allen. And he starts having some real sympathy for how fucked the police are to crushing the will of these gay men just for being gay. And that's like kind of like an interesting thing that happens for a minute and we never get any more resolution on. But like we learn through a conversation that Pacino's like, I don't know. I kind of think how we're treating these people might not be good.
But then, you know, that sets moot by the end. So whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Then they move on. Then they then they go to the next scene.
And right. And so and also Paul Sorvino is like, you know how one of the victims was a Columbia professor and you're like one of the like six victims? Yes. And he's like, here's all of his students. You need to check them out. Maybe one of them is the killer. And you're like, this seems very unlikely considering that the entire investigation has focused to this point on mutual proximity via leather bars. But that ends up being true. It was one of the Columbia professor's students. And is his name Richard Cox? He was the star of Zombie High. I love him. He was in 1 million movies. So we see him and it's clear that he's our killer because it turns out he's lifting weights and working on a doctoral thesis about the history of the American musical. So, you know.
And writing letters to his dead dad.
Yeah. Well, they tell you to do that in the grief books.
And he also has a copy of an illustrated Carl Jung book on the top of his dresser. I think we're supposed to take that as a sign.
Well, everything we get in the discourse, like right down from the guy we're talking about ego at the beginning, like,
yeah,
Billy had just read Jung before he wrote this screenplay. Like, everything that's happening profiling, like the dad stuff, talking to the dead dad, like Will Friedkin wrote, like, read like three young essays before putting the screenplay together.
And was like, I understand now.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a very deep understanding.
No.
But yeah, I do think what he's like hinting at is the Jungian idea of the shadow self.
Yes.
Just like everything you don't like about yourself and you project onto someone else. Mm-hmm. And so here's this closeted gay character who's projecting it onto someone else and then murdering that person.
Right.
It's like, okay, Mr. Psychologist or whatever.
Right. Well, no. And then there's the element of that that's like about sort of infatuation, which is really interesting. And like, that's what we're getting in. That's what we're getting in this character. He's like, just wants his dad to love him and it's too late.
Yeah. So, I mean, at least it's very simple, but it's a relatively coherent motive. And I think that where it gets weird is the idea that Al Pacino, he's losing himself and that he's simultaneously saying that he's losing himself in the gay nightlife and losing himself in becoming a murderer. Because they're just the same thing, you know? You just bang some guys and you're a murderer. I don't know what stops women, but...
Well, into your point, Marcus, about like the shallow take on the shadow self, like that's what Pacino is going through this whole time, is like he's finding some versions of himself in all of this that like he doesn't know what to do with. He's going to be thrilled when he comes out of the room and sees Karen wearing those glasses and the hat.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And I think that there's a read of this of like, well, you know, it's the internalized homophobia that has made these very realistically and richly drawn characters violent. And, you know, and I think that that's there, but it would just be ridiculously charitable to say that that's the only thing there. Mm-hmm. And so, well, guess what? The investigation strategy pays off. Al Pacino keeps going to the bars, and one day, zombie high dissertation killer just happens to want to have sex with him. And they're about to, you know, start to become intimate, and then he pulls a knife. And then they've got him. Hooray! That was easy.
Well, wait. Because he actually doesn't pick him up at the bar.
Oh, right.
He's broken into his apartment earlier.
Oh,
so
God,
he knows where he lives. And so he goes to the guy's apartment and buzzes, but then instead of like getting buzzed in, he just goes and waits across the street and stares at him through the window. And the like killer then puts on all his leather and goes out into the park to meet him. And they have that awkward, flirty scene when they're both sitting on park benches.
Right.
And that, yeah, that leads them to the like line of dialogue. How big are you? Party size. And then what are you into?
That's all I remember.
And then, Pacino knifes him. Okay, sorry. And we're back.
Yeah, no, but so I wasn't fair. So Al Pacino actually is doing some real detective work kind of for the first time in this movie. But he tracks down his guy and brings him in. And isn't it exciting? But wouldn't you know it, he's got that 1,000-yard stare. And Al Pacino goes home to Karen Allen and her beautiful loft that gets bigger every time we look at it. And we have an ending that I think actually demonstrates like how editing works pretty well, where it's like she's put on her one record that she owns. She's put on some of his gear that he left in the living room, his hat and his mirrored sunglasses and the jacket, I think, too. And then we see him kind of gazing at the shadow self in the mirror as he hears her sort of jingling towards him. And then we just cut to the river the same way we saw it when we found a corpse in it at the start of the movie, because he's gazed too long into the abyss and he got fisted by it.
The fist.
Totally. Totally. In that last sequence, though, also we see at night a man striding through the street back to the gay bar, just his back, which we saw at the beginning. Hmm. And we don't know who it is because the murderer is now in the hospital. Mm. And then we also see poor, dear, innocent Ted has been murdered.
Oh, God. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. So beautiful. Yeah. Ted, the star of Squirm, has been murdered. And well, let me read you here. Let's read some YouTube comments. Mike Fiorelli, 1348, says, go to an hour and 35 minutes. This leaves me wondering if they got the real killer, or maybe there are two killers. Go to 10 minutes and 18 seconds and look at the killer's face, then go to an hour, 18 minutes and 25 seconds and look at Stewart's face. These look like two different people. Also, Picciano staring into the mirror at the end seems to suggest this assignment really messed him up. Did Picciano kill the kid at the end, or did the roommate? Maybe Picciano had developed a crush on him, and killing him was his way of taking some weird vengeance against the person that woke up gay impulses. Plus, you'll notice he was having some difficulties getting it on with his girlfriend at one point. Abraxas9340 says, they used a different actor for each killing, I believe. Clint Eastwood6875 says, there were two different killers at first. The first killer, if you notice, gets killed by Stewart, the second. For whatever weird reason, Friedkin dubbed the killer's voice randomly, which causes confusion. When the first killer is walking up and talking to Stewart, it's back to his real voice rather than the dubbed one in the beginning. Then Picciano is allegedly the third killer and kills Ted. So it's kind of like Jason... What's the like ninth Friday the 13th movie Jason that nobody watches? Hell. Jason Goes to Hell.
Yeah, for sure. Did you, an aside that doesn't get to what you were just talking about, but the only YouTube comment I copied and pasted was, I remember seeing this as a teen and how dark it seemed 40 years later, and I'm now a proud member of the BDSM community. Aww. I love that they were like, I'm going to report back.
Good.
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, wait, can we talk about like who is playing who?
Yeah, we have to.
Yeah.
All of these like dark haired men between 25 and 40 are kind of interchangeable, right? Like that's part of the...
Yeah.
We're like losing our grip on reality a little bit. And so the fact that we've got different actors playing the different people, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's multiple killers. Maybe it does, right? So like the first murder at the St. James Hotel, the victim is played by Arnaldo Santana. And the killer is Larry Atlas. And then in the second murder, the victim is Larry Atlas and the killer is Richard Cox.
Wow.
That's in the park. The third murder in the video booth, when the high-powered fashion executive goes into the booth, he's making eye contact with Arnaldo Santana, the first victim. And then when the guy crosses the threshold into the video booth, it changes to the actor as Richard Cox. And yeah, they're all being overdubbed by this guy, the actor who plays the father in the film, James Sutorius.
Wow.
So like James Sutorius's voice comes on and overdubs, for example, when he says, you made me do it. That's the dad's voice. And that sing-songy bit is also him. And then at the end, when they're in the hospital and they've so-called caught the so-called killer, it's Richard Cox's acting. He's the body that's there in the bed. And Richard Cox says, I never killed anyone. And it's the dad's voice again.
So what do you make of that? Because I feel like that's actually, that implies theme.
Well, right. Okay. So in the book, what happens is the reason that he gets caught is because like, it's pretty clear that it's this Stuart Richards character all the way along, but he just gets bored of killing people one at a time and goes to a bathhouse and kills like six or seven people and is taken down by the bathhouse staff.
Wow.
It's like not even the police ultimately that get him.
I love that.
And then after he's been taken in, then Ted is killed. And unlike the previous murders in the book where there was no, like, no semen or whatever found on the bodies.
Right.
When Ted's killed, there is semen. And it's strongly implied that it's the undercover cop who's now completely lost it and had, I think, a consensual sexual encounter with the neighbor and then freaked out and killed him.
What, I mean, and you said before the book, is this correct to paraphrase, like, a rougher experience than the movie?
It is. So like on the one hand, there's no leather bar in it. There's no leather at all. The like obsession with these leather bars comes from Friedkin himself. And in fact, when he was given the book to like the book was optioned by the producer, Jerry Weintraub, who brought it to Friedkin. And Friedkin was like, no leather bars, not interested. And Weintraub was like, you can put the leather bars in if you want. And he's like, okay, well now I'll do the film. So like, that's one big change. The book is also has a really extreme relationship to race. Like the undercover police officer is constantly saying disparaging things about the police captain played by Paul Sorvino because he's Jewish. And in the movie, we only get just a tiny hint of it.
Right.
In the book, there's a bunch of disparaging descriptions of Puerto Rican people.
Of course.
In New York City in the 70s. And then when we get to the movie version, it's a pretty white cast.
which is evidenced by the fact that we can't tell anyone apart.
They all look the same.
Right. Yes. Yes. Some diversity in casting would have been useful. But there's one part where he's in the, where Al Pacino's character is in the park and a bunch of kind of like young people pass him by. And somebody says to him, "Como está Maricón?" Right? Like he's, there's just like a little hint that Latino people are obviously going to be homophobic to him in this moment. So in a movie where all of the violence is enacted by white people, it's like kind of rich to project that instead onto a racial minority.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like, I just generally kind of zooming out, what feels like to me one of the reasons that this movie doesn't work, I think, in the way that it's trying to, is that like not these characters all feel so distant from us, right? Like it feels like you meet someone and immediately the story is underway and it, you don't really have time to know anybody except Don Scardino. He's kind of the only person who I have a real sense of in a way.
Yeah, there, I mean, there are so, to that point, like looking at the cast, there are so many people that I saw on screen for like 3 minutes. And in retrospect, like right after watching the movie, couldn't tell you anything about them. I don't know what Friedkin was going for with that, if it was just sloppy. There is some element of this idea that maybe he thinks he's saying with what is happening with regard to Cruising, and that you're seeing a lot of faces and not getting a lot of context. But I don't think that that's where he was, what he was trying to speak to.
What do you think he was trying to speak to?
Right. All of this is so, like, it's so superficial, right? It's like about appearances. And I think it makes sense given the context that he was going to these bars, but not talking to people.
I feel like I want to talk about something we got into in the George Michael episodes, which is something that also feels like it's underlying this whole movie, is the idea that promiscuity is in itself dangerous.
Yeah, 100%. And that like once you engage in it, you kind of get what's coming to you. Like you don't deserve protection or it's your own fault. Absolutely. I think that's a part of this.
Well, I think we talked about this in the Bones and All episode with Kevin, is like promiscuity itself isn't inherently dangerous. It is dangerous when a culture sort of polices what very narrow ideas of sex or sexuality are allowed and then pushes everything else into shadows that ultimately won't get protected and will themselves be vulnerable. I think there are some ways that this movie tries to touch that and just isn't coherent enough to deliver that message, to you, have you leave the movie going like, oh, like that's the case. And like, I kind of feel like with Friedkin and like knowing sort of his style, and like what he's about, like, just like leather looks cool on screen. And so I think like that's probably as deep as he was going with it. But like, I think like it doesn't necessarily pass judgment on the sex or the frequency of sex or even the sort of style of sex. It is that when something is pushed, not just into a subculture, but like pushed fully into shadows, that's when it becomes dangerous. It's not inherently the act itself, or at least that's my read on how things work.
Well, which I was just going to say that I think the version of promiscuity or casual sex that's portrayed here is one that's very kind of cold, unfeeling, transactional. And that doesn't accord with, I think, a lot of people's actual experience of these kinds of public sex scenarios, that they're often sites of intense community bonding and friendship and camaraderie. And like, because of there's so much emphasis on kind of the superficial, like the image of it, what you're not seeing is what happens before and after. And like for, this is both in terms of promiscuity, but also in terms of the BDSM community, right? Like imagine how this film would have to be different to be able to portray the kind of tenderness that comes in negotiating a scene together. And then like the kind of consent markers that you agree to before you enact the scene. And then that actually depicts aftercare or like the kinds of community building and organizing. I mean, this movie comes out right before the AIDS crisis, but this community will be one of the central hubs for the distribution of safer sex information and for sort of enacting community and care in a moment when the mainstream culture was not paying attention and they were the ones that were sort of coolly uncaring and callous.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that there's, I don't know, maybe the emphasis on, you know, on such an aesthetic and Friedkin and his love of leather, wherever it comes from, God bless. But it also, it feels like the characters in this movie are clothed in a way that is partly about making them as menacing as possible to kind of middle American mall theater viewers.
Right. And like, I think Al Pacino as the kind of like substitute for the audience, the fact that he's kind of being driven into delirium and madness by his participation in this subculture is supposed to tell you about how you as the audience should respond to it.
Right. Yeah. And Pacino as like, how different would this movie feel if it were like anyone else, you know, if it were like, I don't know, who's like a normal man in 1980, William Hurt.
A very different flavor of neuroses would be exercised in that case. Yeah, but to your original question, Sarah, about what we think.
What we talk about when we talk about sluts.
Yeah, exactly. Is that like these stories in one way or another are about ceding control. And then freaking out when you get in an area that is even somewhat gray. And this has to do with sex. This has to do with pleasure. This has to do with finding whatever brings you joy, whatever the things are. I mean, it's like we're the weirdest about sex, but this has a lot to do with this illusion of control and that you can kind of control outcomes. And his freak out is about like, you know, seeing that everything that he assumes about himself might actually, and it might not be that he's like, you know, ultimately a leather daddy to be, but he is realizing that like maybe everything about his concept of self is not fully formed and he's kind of freaking out about it. He's freaking out about it.
It would be nice if we could know anything about this character so yeah. that could
So you don't have to project all true. This.
Right. Because you're just like, maybe, but where is he from? What does he do? Does he have a family? Does he have a dad? What's his relationship with his dad like? Does he like any of this sex he's watching or sort of having or not? We don't know. We just don't know. It's nuts.
Right. And I guess that's part of what you're getting at about the casting, because he has such a kind of tough guy exterior. Like, I'm not going to let you inside. I'm not going to show you what's happening inside. And because certainly the script and the direction isn't going to give us that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what, I mean, I remember, I don't know how national this was, but I grew up in Maine and there was a Cruising Panic in Maine. There was there was a shutting. There are still no cruising signs on the Eastern Promenade in Portland, Maine. So that's a gay panic thing. That's a promiscuity panic thing. That's a slut panic thing. Like, why in the early 1990s was Maine concerned about men driving around?
Well, right. Exactly. Like, in the words of Mariah Carey, why are you so obsessed with me? There's like Stephen Rishnicki says that there's a symbiotic relationship between the park cruiser and the police cruiser. That the police cruiser, in a way, it's part of what like makes their identity is policing what would otherwise be harmless consensual acts in parks. And so like part of it is just like, it's easy, cheap political points to do this. And I also think it's kind of like enacting a fantasy about who is safe and who is unsafe. You know, in that moment of vulnerability during park cruising, it is the cruiser who is the most likely to suffer violence. And so if the police are not interested in protecting them and keeping them safe or investigating violence against them, then turning the kind of arm of the state against the cruiser by criminalizing it and by saying that they are the problem, it's a way of just like offloading responsibility for what they should be doing, which is protecting people and keeping them safe. And like, that's part of why the movie Cruising doesn't really bear much resemblance to reality in the structure of its relationship to policing, because the idea that they would be interested in protecting this subculture from violence is just belied by the history of violence going unchecked, violence against this community from without.
I mean, that to me was the thing that, again, and I'm not trying to give... I'm not trying to exonerate Cruising. I don't think it deserves it. And that's not what I'm going for. And by no means am I trying to be revisionist. But the whole time I'm like, why do they care about this? And then you find out that it's because of like organized political pressure. And that, I mean, don't, whatever. But like the fact that like the police don't have any good intentions. Every time they get involved, it's actually kind of bad. The only good cop, quote, good cop is Al Pacino. And that's because he's so new to it that he actually believes that there's something doable. And we have that great line that you brought up earlier, Marcus, where he says, you know, the police will get him. And then they say they'll make him a member of the vice squad. Like, I like an educated look at the police in this movie because, you know, to your point, there's no situation where out of the purity of the organization of the police force, are they trying to like make any kinds of sex outside of the bounds of the sex that they subject their wives to? Okay. You know, they're so bungling and they're such, yeah, this is like a very outside of their realm.
Yeah, absolutely. I would add to the list of things we've already discussed about why the police are portrayed negatively in this film. There's also, at one point, Al Pacino brings information about the owner of the bar, that he's like some sort of mafioso. And Paul Sorvino's character is just like, nah, I can't touch him. Like, I can't deal with that. Like, there's like insinuation of corruption or grift or money as well.
Yeah. And he's also like, everybody knows that. That's all you figured out.
There's also the character of those two trans women from the beginning of the film. Mm-hmm. Like all the characters, they're described extremely superficially in the film. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting that you chose to use she, her pronouns and describe them as trans women. Mm. I agree with you. And why do you think that that's appropriate?
Well, I mean, as with all things in life, I'm just taking a stab in the night in the park. But my understanding of revisiting a lot of media is that you look at a lot of movies and TV when this language wasn't in the mainstream and you see that they were about trans women all along. And I feel like in a way that's become my assumption, where you have, you know, the sex workers and Sex in the City who Samantha pours water on, or you have like To Wong Fu, where you have characters who are presented to theater goers as drag queens at the time, but you watch it and you're like, I think they're trans women because they're just... never take any of these outfits off, and this is how they live, and it's just who they are, but we don't have that language yet. And so I see, I don't know, just seeing characters at the opening of this movie who are femme presenting, are being harassed by the police, and it's just easier, I think, for my brain as a default to switch to, well, this is how they're living, and this is why they're so vulnerable.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. I also think, you know, in the first scene that we meet the two women, they're both wearing long hair and heels. And then we meet one of them again later at the police station. And she's not wearing the blonde wig anymore, but she's still wearing makeup and has a feminized presentation. And I think breasts. They hadn't originally intended to cast this character as somebody who was trans feminine. Mm. And later changed their casting decision. So that also, I think, would weigh in favor of that. I mean, I'm so happy these two women are here in this film, you know? And part of it is, I think about, there's a new book by Jules Gill Peterson, which is about the history of trans misogyny. Yeah. But one of the things she talks about is this moment in the 1960s where there was the kind of street queen. And the street queen was not a fully formed identity category. And as trans identity got sort of crystallized, that at the same time, there's like a kind of splitting of the street queen into a trans woman who is like a woman who has to go all the way, and then gay men, and that those are separate kind of identitarian categories. And like it's useful to have that separation and to be able to discuss people that way. But Jules Gill Peterson also says, like, what is it that we've lost when we do that? Mm. And I think this, the rest of this movie sort of has some of the consequence, right? There's this like splitting off of the feminine part of the self, casting it out. And then we have this like ultra butch clone leather culture depicted.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Right. It really is such a strange movie. And I think that like there are aspects of it that feel, you know, like classic homophobia. And then there are parts of it where you feel like, are we thinking through some things? Like, is this in its way kind of us catching a view of some aspect of mainstream American culture by representing its fears, therefore telling on itself about what it fears? And that's, you know, and that's the use of all horror in a way.
Yeah, I mean, that's so my read is like, mm-hmm. I don't get the sense that this was a movie made vindictively, right? Like, I get the sense that this is a movie that was made very confidently by someone who should not have had any of the confidence that they did. And I often, you know, it's like we were talking about with the Virgin Suicides, like the rationale for objectification doesn't matter. Objectification is objectification. And so it doesn't necessarily matter the, you know, there's a famous quote about good intentions and roads to hell. I do get the sense that, like, I think William Friedkin thought he was doing something. And it would have been great had he not been so fucking ambitious about every idea that he ever had and was like, maybe this is just for me. Maybe I should work this out by myself. Maybe I should figure out why I'm so into leather bars. Maybe I should
get fisted.
Yeah, rather than make a movie about it.
Yeah.
What's your take, Marcus? You had a lot of faces.
Oh, I was just thinking about, like, thinking back to how gay people responded to it at the time and during filming is instructive, I think, in sort of positioning what it is that they objected to, and maybe there's some insights there. So, like, one of the things that they objected to was just like how much of a straight eye this is, that it's like Friedkin shouldn't be the one at the helm of a project called Cruising, you know? And like, he conducted no consultations with queer people. His consultants were like the owners of the mineshaft, who were these like heterosexual ex-police officers.
Oh, wow.
Right. And so it's like, yeah, you're going to get a bunch of things wrong if you're not talking to the people who you are purporting to tell the story of. So that, I think that's one thing that is a legitimate criticism, and it leads to this film going in some wonky directions that it doesn't have to. The other thing that people were upset about was, you know, only portraying gay people as killers or victims, which is like a very, to return to Sarah's point, very celluloid closet, right? Very like 1970s representation matters. When the only representations of queer people are scary, then that is telling.
Or dead.
Right, yeah. Exactly. That's telling young people something about what to expect in their lives.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that people objected to at the time was like the idea that leather communities are not representative of gay experience. Like, and this I cringe at, because reading gay people's self-reports in the press in the 70s and early 80s, as this movie was being filmed and then premiered, there was some ambivalence about this, and then ambivalence about the ambivalence, as in, what are you so embarrassed about? Why are you embarrassed that we're showing leather people and BDSM culture?
Right. Well, I mean, and that's still the weirdest tension that, right, that comes up every year that like Folsom Street Fair happens, where it's like the weirdest tension is the large conversation that happens around how representative is this community sort of with regard to the queer community, and then how representative is it not? And it depends on sort of like who is having that conversation. And usually that conversation is being like sloppily weaponized in some way. So like, you know, William Friedkin is not the person to show that nuance.
Right. And I think it's also like in queer culture, there's often this pressure that everything has to be for everybody.
Right.
And it's okay that some things aren't for everybody or aren't a representation of everybody. That doesn't mean that other people and other representations don't exist. Like where we're at, right, like at the end of the 1970s and the beginning of 1980, queer people are really starved for representation in this moment. And there isn't the kind of panoply of different types of representation. So like, I can see where that criticism might have a different valence now than it would have then.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, you know, there's some fun parts in this movie, some titillating parts, but isn't it great that now we don't have to like depend for our representation on these kind of heterosexual fantasies of our lives? You know, the people who were protesting the film, I wish I could just like whisper in their ear that just a few years from now, Desert Hearts is coming and My Beautiful Laundrette is coming and the films of Pedro Almodovar are coming and Gregor Rocky and, you know, this like flourishing, this outpouring of queer cinema is on its way. And we don't have to anymore be so concerned about any single representation and does it reflect us? I also, so like, I don't want this to come down as like being against the folks who were protesting because they were beautiful and ingenious and creative people. Like one of the things about it is that Friedkin tried to control access to information about filming. But of course, every film crew is full of queer people. And so the word would just get out, you know? And sometimes there was 1,000 people on the street and they needed 300 cops and barricades to keep them from the filming scene.
My God.
And sometimes it was like five guys in the apartment next door who just got a radio and played it really loud and banged on pots and pans. Or like
that's great.
One guy on a roof across the street who has a giant reflector and is like screwing up the lighting in the scene.
What we really need is a movie about people protesting cruising.
That's absolutely. I would love that.
And like all these diverse gay characters with different lives and relationships and feelings and families all shining a bright light in Al Pacino's eyeballs.
There's a great article by Scott Tucker, which came out in 1979 in the gay and lesbian newspaper, The Body Politic, which outlines in some detail the efforts to stop the filming of Cruising. And it's really beautiful. One of the scenes that he describes is himself at the Ramble, where a lot of gay cruising in New York happened in Central Park. And they had cordoned off the part of the Ramble where gay men usually cruise because of the filming. Like, so Cruising the movie had monopolized the cruising space. And so, of course, the guys were just laying out in the park, cruising each other in the grass instead.
That's marvelous.
Okay, can we talk about some of his directing choices? Like,
yes.
Please.
The addition of these subliminal scenes.
Mm-hmm.
When the first victim is getting stabbed, they cut in a few frames of like anal sex from a porno.
Huh.
And like, I'm sure Friedkin was like, oh, I'm such a genius.
Right.
It's penetration with a knife and penetration anally.
All right, Tyler Durden.
He's like, I'm scared of both of these equally.
Well, and there's, I mean, that reminds me of a moment. It's like a very small moment, but Al Pacino is at one of these bars and a guy just like reaches over and caresses his pec. And then we like cut to the next thing. And I feel like that's meant to be like, what would you do? Can you imagine someone caressing your pec? And it's like, what's going on here? Why are we so upset about this?
My father, who I, you know, well-intended man, messy, well-intended man, warned me the most about was at some point in a bathroom or on a bus, I was going to get caressed by a stranger.
Hmm.
And there was something, it's sad, but in retrospect, it's so funny that it's such a non-violent thing he was warning me about.
Yeah.
Like that he was like, so there, someone's going to put their hand on your thigh. And it's like, yeah, okay.
And, you know, and look, we all have a right to live happily and to not feel our bodies being infringed upon in public places, etc.
For sure.
But I have had a fantasy since I was 14 about having my thigh caressed in a consensual, silent, stranger public way. And it's never fucking happened. When? That's all.
I mean, I will say that, like, that when it comes to cruising, as it's actually practiced, the steps are so tentative leading up to the first touch. Like, it's almost Victorian, right?
Mm.
So somebody would sidle up near you at the bar and then closer to you. And then, like, put their hand near your butt, you know, like the moment that we see where Al Pacino's peck is caressed, we don't know really what precedes it, but they're like, I do think the character is sort of enjoying it in that moment. And also when he, like, there's a moment where he gets invited out onto the dance floor. He's like, oh, I'm with someone. And the guy's like, aren't we all? And then like, they just go and dance on the dance floor together. He seems to be having a genuinely good time.
Yeah.
But also there's a kind of like, I don't know, he's tense, right? In that moment.
Oh yeah.
Yo, yeah.
We just needed one monologue for this character. Just one. Just say some shit to Karen Allen, my God, about your dad, something, anything.
It's so much about the fear of surrender. And like, even when he, to your point, like when he does dance, he's somehow all right angles. Like he's rigid.
He dances like Crispin Glover in Friday the 13th part four.
He's all elbows and angles and like he's so hard.
This is too big a question for an entire episode, and yet I'm asking it anyway, which is
that's never stopped you before, sir.
Exactly. I feel like in the 90s, and you know, still to an extent, but there was a while there where we were hearing a lot about the gay panic defense. What is that supposed to mean, and what did we take it to mean as a public?
Right. I mean, the idea in the law was that someone, when they were hit on by another man, mm-hmm. would be so overcome with their revulsion that their natural manly reaction would be to murder the person who had hit on them.
Mm-hmm. Which we all accept would be a reasonable, like maybe it was a little too much, but we understand how we got there. That's like the expectation of the panic defense.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And that feels like it's animating this movie, is like some kind of shared understanding on behalf of the men that this was written by and for. I think that like, of course this would be an experience that would drive you completely insane. Right. And it's like, what it,
well, I mean, that's why, to me, again, it's like why it was so wild to hear like someone might like touch you. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about like a sort of forceful assault or anything. It was like, someone might touch you. And it was rooted very much in like kind of like the assumed magic, surreal magic of the gay panic defense, that even that, like that touching might be something that would like break me psychically.
Well, it is part of the fear that like, if you're touched by another man and you don't immediately hate it, then like, oh no, oh no.
Well, come 13, he stopped warning me about it because he's like, I assume if that happens to you, you might be okay with it.
Oh, that's nice.
He did, his tune did change eventually, but like when I was young, it was, and to be honest, I mean, like our family was so involved in like Catholic Church stuff and stuff like that. He might've been warning about other,
yeah.
It might not so much have been about strangers on buses as it was like trusted people in the community.
Well, that's, you know, he could have been more precise though.
But yeah, totally. Talk to me about which predators, Dad.
And it's also like, these ideas of bodily integrity and autonomy are things that we only, our culture only allows men to have.
Yeah. Oh God. Yes.
Right. I think there's also something a little bit brain breaking for heteronormativity to think about cruising as something that isn't, because we can only conceive of sex within this culture as something scary that like happens to you or at you, you know? And it's like, well, who's the sex victim? Who's the one who all this is happening to and who feels sort of scared? And it's like,
yeah,
I'm going to stop you right there.
Well, I think all of this is about, in so many of our conversations recently in one way or another, are about policing in keeping, quote, sacred, an extremely narrow idea of what sex is.
Yeah.
And it's, sex is a thing a man does to a woman.
Yeah. Specifically, a man thrashing around until a baby appears.
That's beautiful. And everything else has some level of taboo that needs to be policed out of existence. Mm-hmm. And so if, God forbid, there is joy involved, God forbid there is a conversation, you know, to all of Marcus's points about we're only seeing the sex in this movie as something transactional and dangerous and not something that has a beginning or an end outside of murder, you know, God forbid we learn that it can lead to letting loose
one way or another. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a world it would be if we could embrace exploration and uncertainty and sort of playfulness in trying to figure out what our sexual likes and dislikes are.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to do like some cartoon fan fiction of Cruising where just like Al Pacino actually has a whole date with somebody and then like cries in his arms. It's what he really needs. Because he's just a character who has no development or arc aside from the fear that what he's doing is taking over him in a way that makes him both gay and a murderer simultaneously because they're equally scary. And it feels like William Friedkin, in his hubristic way, is like, I feel like the best thing that he could say about his intents is like, I tried to make a movie about how internalized homophobia is so terrible. And it's like, yes, well, you did, I guess. But you also made a movie about how internalized homophobia makes gay men, you know, murder each other. So that's not, it's not, you got to pick your moment for that kind of story.
It's a way of completely letting heterosexual culture off the hook to say that the killers of gay men are other gay men.
Yeah.
And the reason that gay men are getting killed is because of their own behaviors and their own, quote, risky lifestyle, unquote. Right?
Right.
Right. And it's like, you know who kills gay people? Not straight people. Don't worry about that.
Not in this universe, right? Like, not in this movie world. And it's like, so I think this movie is wrong about sex for all of the reasons that we just discussed. And it's also wrong about violence at the same time, right? Like we're in a world of BDSM, which is a world in which any kind of violence that is enacted is extremely rules-based and orderly and negotiated in advance and contained, you know? It's like a box to play with something that you're feeling about. And outside of that box is the kind of non-consensual, spontaneous outpouring of hatred and violence that this film doesn't feel the need to like deal with separately than just like leather culture.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's making leather culture stand for really the toxic elements of straight America. So beautiful sleight of hand there. I hate it.
Right? I mean, are there any toxic elements of straight culture that are actually depicted here other than maybe the fact that Al Pacino's character is too wounded to express himself other than very obliquely to Karen Allen?
Yeah, I know. I love how much they don't talk about anything.
I do think the fact that our first police officers are sexual predators.
Yeah.
I do think that that is helpful. But again, yeah, like that becomes negated by all of the things narratively you just described, that it's like, that's a footnote, not a part of the text.
Yeah. And that feels like insurance against what the rest of the movie is potentially.
Very well said, for sure.
I mean, I think what it ultimately reflects is that there's not a coherent view of sexuality depicted in this film. Just like the plot isn't quite coherent.
Yeah.
What it's trying to say isn't coherent either.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. And, you know, I hope William Friedkin figured himself out sexually. And our many problems in media aside, I do think we live in a time when our view of sex isn't decided by the same 35 white men. And that's really nice.
It's also an extremely valuable lesson to anyone who's making a thing in public that could serve as a statement to say, if I'm working something out, how much of it is about me and how much would I benefit from just like listening right now rather than making a statement about what I'm trying to figure out?
Yeah. And why am I using real people as an allegory for my feelings when they are, yes, in fact are real and have their own feelings?
100%, right? Like, I think these days, a filmmaker couldn't make a film like this without declaring their subject position and consulting with the communities that are affected by the film. Like, you would get blowback, I hope, if you made a movie like Cruising without having heavy consultation with like the BDSM community, for example.
Well, it's wild to me that you can just hear someone say begrudgingly, you could never make this movie today. And it's like, well, good.
Thank God. At least we've done something that we wouldn't make Cruising fantastic again, I hope. My question is, are we recommending this movie?
With all these caveats.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I'm going to say thumbs up for Cruising, fists up for Cruising. Like, not necessarily as entertainment, but as one of, to me, the most revealing kind of museum piece movies about what in God's name people thought was a coherent plot for a movie in 1980 and where we were as a culture, that this was a movie that, you know, was made on purpose. I think if you're a student of history, you got to watch this one. And if you like bad movies, this is a bad movie in an entertaining way. It's just interesting to see something that is put together by someone who clearly knew how to make good movies at other times in his life, but this wasn't one of them.
Yeah. Marcus, what's your take?
I agree with all of that. I think it's easier to accept this movie, to watch this movie and be charmed by it in 2024 than it would have been in 1980.
Oh my God.
The things that are the straight fantasy of gay culture are less important or less wounding feeling now than they might have been in 1980. Mm. And the sheer depiction of those men in those clothes, in those leather bars, is so delightful.
Mm. Yeah. I know. I want to know about them.
Yes, exactly. But like, I feel like now you have to watch it as a museum piece in a way, as opposed to it's not a documentary of a culture. It's like, here's what a straight guy thought was going on there at the time.
Yeah. It's a documentary about straight culture, which is very helpful because we have no other insights into it.
Right. It's like how The Virgin Suicides is like about those girls, but it's about those girls from the boys' perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what this movie is.
Yeah. But The Virgin Suicides is about a girl watching boys watching girls, and that's why it works.
Whoa.
It's a good frame.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, like, I don't ever want people to feel compelled to experience something that they think is going to complicated feelings that they have not yet resolved, or triggering feelings or whatever. But I do think watching this as an artifact to understand even just like the controversy at the time and like the actual just like issues with portraying a culture that is not yours, that you don't have proximity to, that you only see in an objective fashion, is good. It's stacked with lessons about like what not to do now.
Mm.
Well, we know that Stewart had a father that he was in communication with occasionally, even though he was dead. Who, in your view, was the daddy of Cruising?
I think the daddy of the film is the protesters who disrupted the film. Mm. And maybe especially the gay production crew that kept leaking the schedule.
Beautiful. I am going to pick, for no character strengths, I'm just going to pick Paul Sorvino. No matter what age, I looked up Paul Sorvino's age in this movie. He's 41 years old. I am 40. And I was like, this man is easily 57 years old in this movie. Nope. He's 40 years old.
That is a hard life, 41.
The guy who played Clemenza was like basically my age.
There's just like something about his presence. I love Paul Sorvino's presence. And I think it's because I grew up so hard with Goodfellas, but like, it's like at once fatherly and like kind of disappointed and like really exasperated all the time. There's something about that presence that's like doing a lot all at the same time while like also being soft.
Mm-hmm.
He's got layers that are not necessarily transferable role to role. They're Paul Sorvino layers. And I love them every time I see them. Sarah Marshall, who is your Cruising daddy?
My daddy is that guy who's getting fisted right in the middle of the club. God bless him.
Oh, yeah.
Happy for him.
Absolutely.
Marcus, thank you for, at this point, you've spent like 19 hours of your life talking to me.
Oh, what a pleasure. What a treat.
Thank you for this episode and for taking us on the George Michael journey on You're Wrong About. And remind us again, what's your book called and where can people find it?
I have a new book called Park Cruising, What Happens When We Wander Off the Path, which is a book of essays about cruising, law, culture, sociability. And it's available wherever better books are sold. I'm also on Instagram at my first initial and my last name, but without any vowels. So MMCCNN.
Excellent. Thank you. This has been a joy.
Yeah. Alex, you are in your late 20s.
Wait, am I allowed to laugh at that or not supposed to laugh at that?
No, it's the funniest lie imaginable.
Our right, everybody. That is it for this week's episode of You Are Good, a Feelings Podcast About Movies. Thank you so much to Marcus McCann for joining us. Thank you to Miranda Zickler for producing and editing the episode. Thank you to Carolyn Kendrick, our founding producer. Thank you to Fresh Lesh for providing the beats that make our episode sound so sweet. Thank you, of course, to Alyssa Onofrio for providing video edits of each week's episode that you can find over on TikTok and Instagram. Find us on social at You Are Good or You Are Good Pod. Find us on Patreon or Apple Podcast subscriptions where you can get those bonus episodes and support us. We'll talk with you all next week. Thank you so much for being here. I can't believe we get to do this, and we get to do this because you keep showing up for it. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And don't forget, if no one else tells you before the next time we all meet here again, that you, my friend, are good.